This episode is brought to you by
RPG Now, the leading source of indie role-playing games, with over 10,000 RPG titles from over 500 creators and publishers. There are new RPG treasures to discover every day at www.rpgnow.com.
This podcast is sponsored by GMDice.com. You can never have too many dice.
And listeners like you. Thanks for using the Tomes Amazon store.
This is Shane Hensley, creator of Deadlands Reloaded and Savage Worlds, and you're listening to the Vorpal Network.
Hey there, this is Nicholas Logue, author of Crown of the Cobalt King, and you are listening to the Tome.
Welcome to the Tome, episode 97. The Tome is a D&D news, reviews, and interviews show, and I'm your Tome host, Jeff Greiner. In this episode, we're braving a dragon's lair to get our hands on the Draconomicon. But before we get into the book, I wanted to thank our first sponsor, RPGNow.com. RPGNow is a fantastic site to buy PDF gaming books from such as my pick of the episode, the Counter Collection 4th Edition Heroic 1 from Fiery Dragon, which has a bit of a long and confusing name, but what this is a collection of printable tokens of all the heroic tier monsters in the 4th edition Monster Manual 1. As of this recording, it's only $12.50, quite a bargain considering what you can do with this, and that it has a normal cost of $35.
Get the newest releases at RPG Now. Only at RPG Now can you get the absolute latest and best releases from fantastic publishers like Fat Dragon Games, Green Ronin Publishing, and Wizards of the Coast. There are new products every single day. Come to RPGNow.com and get them the instant they're available.
In this episode, I am joined by Quinn Murphy, the game fiend of the At Will blog, as well as Dave Chalker from the Critical Hits blog, as we talk about the Draconomicon Chromatic Dragons. The Draconomicon is intended to be a book for DMs who want to have more dragons in their game of dungeons and, dragons. It fleshes out details of how to use them in your game, what to do with them, how to play them, and then gives you stats for the new dragons, new draconic creatures, and unique dragons. The two guest hosts for this episode are fantastic experts in the game and have done a ton of writing on D&D, so you can certainly trust their opinions. So let's see if the book lives up to what it wants to do. But I do want to quickly point out to you our second sponsor of the episode, GMDice.com, where my pick of the episode is a real stone obsidian dice set for $22.50. Seriously not bad for the real thing.
Hello, this is Richard Hatch from Battlestar Galactica. When you play a role-playing game, do you like to have your own dice? GMDice.com is one of the best selections of dice on the internet. From stone dice to metal dice and even bone dice, GMDice.com is your dice store.
Welcome back. I am here with Dave Chalker from Critical Hits, if I can say your name. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you. My name's not hard to pronounce, but, good to be here.
I'm just a horrible person. And we also have Quinn, the game fiend from the At Will blog. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yep. And we are going to talk tonight about Draconomicon, Chromatic Dragons, written by Bruce Cordell, Ari Marmel, and Robert J. Schwab.
Draconomicon's a book about the undead, right?
Yeah, that's the one. Draconomicon is intended to be a book for DMs and to give us more options and ideas on how to run good dragon encounters. And we're going to sort of go through it and see how well it does that job. So it starts off with the dragon lore section in chapter 1. This is the section where you sort of get the old bestiary feel from this section. I don't know if anybody else felt that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Although, I'll be honest, on this and some of the – in the open grave there, this is the part I'm glad it's there, but I usually skip it. One day I'll need it, and I'll be going, thank the heavens that they included that. But until then, I usually want to get right to the meat of it.
Yeah, this is the kind of section that I usually read for curiosity. but almost never impacts my game.
Yeah, I do the same where I sort of skip over it when first going through it, and I'll come back and be like, oh, neat, dragon skeletons, you know. But my first pass through, it's like, okay, on to the rules.
Yeah, and if it's well written, then I, you know, this is the part that I read more for, you know, the enjoyment of reading.
It's a lot like the, in this case, a lot of it's sort of repeated from the old Draconomicon,
yeah,
which was one of my favorite third edition books. So I didn't feel as compelled to piece through it as much anyway.
Right. I do always enjoy sort of looking through some of the, this is what a dragon's like at the different stages of their life, especially since the stages of a dragon's life are different in fourth edition. I liked the way they tried to pull into that section. This is the kind of plots that a dragon might be working on at that point in their life.
Yeah, I mean, our group for a little while, years and years ago, was heavily into the Council of Worms setting. And that was a lot of, you know, let's start out as hatchlings and we have adventures as hatchlings, and then, you know, you grow up as a dragon as you gain XP, and then you do different things. Right. So it's pretty neat to see that feel recreated, even if you probably can't do that with the rules anymore, at least included. Mm-hmm. It's that same sort of stories you see presented.
Yeah. And I found the idea of environmental diffusion. Do you remember that from any previous books? And how the dragons will sometimes, when they die, they'll just sort of evaporate into this elemental energy that sticks around for a little while. I didn't remember seeing that in previous editions about the dragons, and so that concept in this chapter sort of stood out to me as something interesting that you could put in.
Yeah, I don't remember it being in any previous edition. There's a lot of stuff about dragon graveyards and whatnot previously. Yeah. This whole evaporation thing is pretty new.
Yeah, that seems pretty new to me.
And then it talks a little bit about the outlook and psychology of the dragons. Once again, this is a place to look. It seems to get ideas for getting yourself into the heads of these dragons, because it's kind of hard to think like a creature that is that powerful and that old and has that long of a lifespan. And so being able to sort of have some tips on getting into their heads and, you know, why are they so into their horde, or, you know, why is that important to them, or how do you play off a dragon that's appropriately arrogant and that kind of things, helps me come up with ideas of how to role play a dragon, which I think is the idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of the time you're not going to be using that stuff for, you know, there's a boss dragon in this dungeon, but, if you really are diving into making a heavy dragon campaign, as part of, you know, main villains and that kind of thing, it really does help.
Yeah, I think some of the main value here, too, is obviously we've all been playing D&D for a while. So, you know, we can sort of pick and choose what we want out of this. But if you were a new DM coming into this stuff, this would be pretty crazy and valuable.
Yeah, I would think
so. To know all this.
Yeah, I agree.
And the same thing with the next little section where it talks about the dragon society and how the dragons interact with each other. Now, they've made some changes, it seems to me, in terms of... I guess it seems like there are some changes in terms of the background and their connection to the gods and the different dragon gods. But by and large, I mean, it's all just sort of a long list of different things to know about how dragons work in society, and how they work with, you know, with each other. So, again, bringing in more role-playing ideas of how to bring in a dragon that's more than just the big boss at the end of the dungeon.
Yep, it also, Tiamat and Bahamut are so much bigger in this edition. And a lot more advice about how to weave that in, yeah. Where previously they were like, okay, dragons have gods and gnolls have gods and so on, and here are their names, you know?
And then it gets into some more detailed looks at the various chromatic dragons, where it looks at the kinds of you know, it takes a little section for each dragon, and it talks about, you know, this is their general proportions and sizes and how much they weigh, what kind of treasure they like, where they're likely to live. And then it also gives you those little snippets of optional rules to make your dragons a little bit feel a little bit more like it's important what color they are. Now, what did we think about those optional rules? Is it just too, are they too cumbersome, or do they add that unique flavor that maybe they should have been there originally?
Most of them seem like things that aren't player visible, really. Like the fact that a green dragon in thickly forested or other vegetation, heavy terrain, gains a +4 bonus to stealth check. That, you know, I mean, you'll make a roll for stealth, but the players won't, unless you're telling them, won't know that kind of thing. So, you know, it's a hit or miss. You know, it's nice to include, I guess, that flavor, but it's that sort of flavor that only DMs are going to really see for the most part, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, and I don't know that as a DM that I'd remember those things most of the time.
Well, yeah, that's my thing, is that I almost feel like if they were going to do this kind of stuff, I don't mind it. I think it makes sense, but maybe they should have just included it in the original stat block so that it's all in one place and I'd remember that it was there.
Right.
Yeah, those stat blocks are so stripped down now, though, that I think that's where they want to push content like that. I just wish, like in the compendium, that stuff was in there, so I could just copy and drop that in.
Oh, sure. Well, and I think you're absolutely right. I think the reason that we don't see those little optional rules is exactly for that reason, because they strip down the stat blocks to try to make them at the bare minimum. This is what you absolutely need to run this in an encounter. But yeah, now we start to see some of the downfall of that, is that we're missing some of the little nuances and details that make a blue dragon that much more unique compared to a, you know, purple dragon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yep.
And we also get our first look at the new chromatic dragons in this section. The brown dragons, the gray dragons, and was the other one purple? Yes, the purple dragons.
Yep, yep.
And I'm sure we'll have more opportunities to chat about them as we get into some more rules-heavy sections of the books. Any other thoughts on that first chapter where we figure out all about what's going on with the physiology and the psychology of dragons?
I was reading another review, I think it was on Dungeon Mastering, and got into one of my comment battles with somebody, but they were saying they hate it, like it ruined the book for them because of that chapter, where it turned dragons into like reptiles, right? Like they're not magical things, they're these really ordinary things. And that sort of baffled me. You know, a lot of that's, when you put it in the context of a game, it's going to be in the hands of the game master and the players buying into it.
Right.
But you also have the groups where, like, they're probably going to ask, you know, how long does this dragon's spine run, you know?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly the sort of question I expect to come up from my players on a regular basis.
Yeah.
And at the same time, even if it wasn't there, would it be hard for me to come up with that? No. Do I need all the physiology? Not really. Like we said before, a lot of that is interesting to read. But it is minutia. It's not going to come up very often in a game, and infrequently enough that it wouldn't be tough to make it up on the fly if I needed to. But at the same time, it's only 40 pages. And it's sort of a classic format. I mean, pretty much every monster-based book for ages has had that opening, you know, bestiary section.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, too, it's the theme of verisimilitude, right? You know, like you were saying, you know, you can make that up on the fly, but it's one of those things that has an effect. If someone asks, how long is the dragon's spine? And, you know, even if you didn't make it up, if you said, let me go look it up, like, you know, the fact that it's there and that it's been thought of and that there's some sort of consistent reality actually makes your fantasy better because it makes it a little bit more real. I mean, dragons aren't real, but if they're well conceived, they can feel real for the session.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the issue that it makes them too much like lizards, and it takes some. I'm guessing that the issue was that it takes some of the mystery out, right? They're no longer mm-hmm. these odd, fantastical, magical creatures because it's all explained. Yeah, but it's only explained to people with the science background that we have in a modern age, you know?
Yeah.
In a fantasy setting, it's going to seem very mysterious and magical. And honestly, I mean, even with the pseudoscience used to explain it, I mean, it's still fairly magical that they can produce, you know, lightning out of their mouth.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
There's not too many good scientific explanations for that.
Yeah, and yeah. Really, is your elf fighter going to be like, well, if I sever the seventh vertebrae here, that'll have lasting effects, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
But then we'll move on to Chapter 2, The DM's Guide to Dragons. This has all the tips and tricks given to DMs wanting to put dragons into their game, including just sort of some tips on putting together encounters that have dragons, whether it be combat encounters or different skill challenges.
Mm-hmm.
But it also gives us some traps and things that a dragon might stick into their lair. I'm finding that I like all the different traps and hazards and obstacles and the rules for that. The more I've played with them, the more I've used them, and the more I see them in different books, the more I like that. But as a DM, it's starting to turn a little bit into, feats or spells were in previous editions, where there's not a ton, but there's a smattering of these things in every single book.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in a module, you know, I use the rules for them. But when I'm planning my own stuff, I don't set them out like an official trap and here's the steps, you know. I haven't yet gotten to that point where I've detailed it in the ways that they do in the official books. Now, if I have it there right in the course of the adventure, then I'll use it. But
sure,
I'm not sure that if I run an adventure around a dragon's horde that I would specifically pick up and drop one of these traps in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. I have done stuff like that, and it's worked pretty well, but it does require a bit of extra note-taking. I guess I don't like to be flipping through books in the middle of my game, so I sort of take everything down on notes and have it ready to go for each individual room or encounter or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of details that aren't always necessary in the way the traps are set out. You know, when I write them down, or when I've created my own, I do a very abbreviated version.
Hmm. Yeah, my biggest issue with them as they set these out in the books is, like you were saying, there's just enough to go through, but not, you know, if for some reason you're not exactly blown away with the four or five they have in there,
uh-huh.
then you really didn't get anything out of that part of it, you know. And of course, there's plenty more to get out of the book. But it'd be nice if that part was expanded a bit.
Sure.
So maybe you had, you know, 20 things to choose it from, you know, 10 to 20 things to choose from. Gives you a lot of options and even just inspiration if you'd like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Then it gets into a section on adventures and how to set up whole, not just an encounter, but an adventure, various quests and that kind of stuff. Just more of just seeding ideas into how to put dragons and make them interesting in your game.
Yeah, with the levels and the quest XP, I really like that this book sort of sets a tone for all the DM books, and it shows that we're not just going to give you really rough ideas. We're going to use every single one of those rules in the DMG and carry it through into this product. So, you know, these adventure hooks also have a level to them. They have quest XP. There are skill challenge. There are traps and hazards. There's pretty much all those points.
Yeah.
It's also in the section like the treasure parcels. You know, here's some example hoard treasure parcels.
Yeah, and I like that they've done some of that. A lot of it, I think, is a good idea because the edition is so new. This gives a DM just that many more examples of how it can the general rules of the DMG can be applied to a specific situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it goes so far as to give you ideas in your adventure on how to use dragons as patrons, and then expands even further. You know, they started with encounters, then they went adventures, and now they're finishing or going further into saying, here's how you can some ideas to set up a whole campaign of dragon focus, which is something you're actually doing. Am I right, Quinn?
Actually, there's just dragon sort of the players just finished an arc in the story where they're going up against some younger dragons, and then it'll tie back into the story there. So there's smatterings of it in the campaign. They're sort of spilled around.
Sure, sure. And then, yeah, like you had said before, Dave, then it gets into this whole section on hordes and how to use the system that we already have to make sense of a dragon horde and how to parse it all out.
Yeah, I also found it interesting that this was the book that, like, Trade Goods was introduced in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they do start doing some of that in here. Yeah, I've noticed they do that on they've done that on several books. They did the same sort of thing with the, was it the Forgotten Realms campaign setting, where there was just randomly stuck in, it seemed, a spot on, here's how you can make more interesting art objects.
Oh, yeah, right.
It's like, okay, well, great, but this is nothing to do with the realms. This is just how to make more interesting art objects in any game.
I know. I mean, maybe this stuff is going to make a comeback in DMG 2, but it seems odd to toss it in there.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I wonder if it wouldn't have been better to take all of these things and just sort of pull them out and put them in DMG 2.
Mm-hmm. Either DMG 2 or I think some of this stuff, honestly, would make really good insider content. I say this as somebody with an insider subscription, so I guess I'm okay with that. But I think if I got that PDF with the insider stuff, I think that would be really cool.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know that they've stretched what they want to do with insider enough. I agree with you that this would be the sort of thing that you'd want to put in insider, maybe even as like a bonus tool or something, not necessarily in dragon.
Yeah.
Like have your own compendium kind of rules compendium sort of thing for it, where you could like, you know, have tables and generate stuff and look at it. That'd be pretty awesome.
Yeah. It'd be, well, if nothing else, it'd be interesting if they could put together a one of those little bonus tools and just say, this is the level of treasure that I need, and have it randomly generated. And I know they're moving away from randomly generated, but they could, I mean, it still would be very easy to trade in and out different magic items and have the rest of it randomly generated, because I don't necessarily need to think out every single art object that I put into my game.
Yeah,
and you can see that people online, like Asmore, have put together stuff like that already, because people need it, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then it finishes off, if I remember right. That's the end of the section. Deals with artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
And
artifacts and rituals, right?
And then rituals, yeah, yep. Yeah. And so the artifacts, some of which I recognize as standard classics, and some I don't recognize, but that doesn't mean they haven't been around. The one that I definitely recognize is the Orb of Dragonkind. They specifically give you blue, but it would be easy to see how this could be translated into other colors as well.
Yeah, which you'd have to do if you wanted to recreate the D&D movie in 4th edition.
Right. Or the Dragonlance campaign.
Right, well, that too.
Any artifacts that stand out as particularly interesting to you?
They're all pretty cool. I kind of like, just on the naming convention there, it's Ilthuvial's Blackened Heart.
Yeah.
It's suitably melodramatic. I like it.
Well, and other than the blue Orb of Dragonkind, they've all got some sort of name attached to them, right? Spear of Orok the Brave.
The Unconquered Standard of Arcosia is probably my favorite.
Well, good. And then, yeah, it gets into rituals after that. Just a fairly small smattering of rituals to help your dragons do their dragony sorts of things. They're not the kind of rituals that are necessarily there for PCs. which is why I think it still works in a DM book. You know, I don't feel like PCs should have to run out, should feel like they need to get the Draconomicon so they have access to these new rituals. Because first of all, there's only like, what, 7 of them?
Yeah.
And second of all, they're intended to be used by the bad guys. Now, if the DM wanted to include a scroll or whatever as part of the treasure and pass out one of these rituals, that makes sense to me. But it would also make sense that this isn't the kind of thing that you're going to see, you know, in the magic store in town or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. And they could be interesting story things, like they need to seek out these rituals for a specific dragon thing that they need to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, and I forgot there's a section after that on components. Using dragon parts as components in your ritual casting. This is an issue that actually came up in the last session of my 4th edition game. And I had to pull out my Draconomicon and said, ha-ha, I have rules for this. You killed the blue dragon, now you want to carve it up and use its parts for things, and now I have rules on how you can do that.
I think there's like one player in every group that really likes to take parts off monsters.
Well, I've got one player in my group who likes to take parts off of everybody. The first thing he did, when one of the PCs died was he cut off his arm. That PC wasn't particularly happy when he was brought back to life later. And then it gives you, I guess, a little section on some famous dragons throughout different campaigns. You've got Dragonlance, Greyhawk, and the Forgotten Realms. I don't know. That section didn't seem... I mean, it's only a page, but seems... eh. You know, it doesn't particularly do anything for anybody unless they're running that campaign, in which case, shouldn't that information be in the campaign?
Yeah. And it seems sort of more like a shout-out. Sort of like dragon name-dropping.
That's exactly what it seems like. You know, yeah. Now, if they want to include stats for those dragons in this book, that works for me. But yeah, mm-hmm. It's just a page and a half of name dropping.
Yeah, well, they do have famous dragons in the back, too, which is why it's kind of weird.
Right.
Like, here's some dragons that are really cool, but we're not going to give you stats for.
Yeah. And then it gets into setting up layers, dragon layers for Chapter 3. And there's all kinds of different ideas for layers in terms of how you want to set it up and things to think about when you're setting up a layer. And you know, the idea of setting up an urban layer or a planar layer, those kinds of things are interesting to me as just a way to mix things up and throw the players off guard because they're not expecting it.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it just goes into example after example after example of different layers.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
What
that are all statted out like encounters.
Right. What do we think about using a good sized chunk of a book to give you just tons of examples of different dragon layers? Is that something you guys use in a game? Have you ever used something like that in a game?
Personally, I love it just because, like, I always see these DM books as sort of sources of inspiration and things to steal, I mean, borrow. Heavily from.
Absolutely.
And so having like stuff like maps and things like that, you know, okay, I could steal, you know, I might either lift it directly or I'll borrow bits of it and use it as inspiration for something else that I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, and then if there's a good encounter in there, so I usually pick at these things over time a lot. Like I'll just go through the, you know, layer, see if there's something good in there, and then I'll pull it out. So personally, I love it.
Sure. Now, personally, I guess in 20 years of playing the game, I've never used anything like this. And it just seems like, I mean, it's taking up 70 pages of the book that I in a lot of ways, I feel like could have been better used. At the same time, as I'm getting to a point in my life where I have less and less time to prepare for games, this does become a lot more tempting, you know, to pull this out and start flipping through it and saying, oh, this is kind of like what I need, and I can change this room and that room, and it's perfect, you know, and to save myself a lot of prep time in a game. So I haven't used it to date, but it is becoming more tempting in my life to use this kind of thing. I think maybe they went a little overboard, because, like I said, it's 70 pages, and the book's not that long.
I feel sort of halfway about it, where I do like that there are these pre-made encounters and there's a lot of stuff to be inspired by. But at the same time, a lot of them just end up reading like another dungeon crawl.
Yeah.
Here's another room. You know, there's a pool of water on the floor and, you know, 17 dragon hatchlings, roll initiative. You know, like, if there were more variety in them, it would be a better use of space. But as it is, I feel like the big picture and then a couple of the key encounters are all that I need instead of, you know, every room.
Well, and to sort of go along with that, I feel like they've done really well on a few of the rooms in a few of the encounters and making them engaging and interesting. But one of the things I'm really trying to work on as a DM in 4th edition is making the environment of my encounters more dynamic, which is one of the big things they push for in 4th edition. And in a lot of the encounters that they've statted out, they kind of fall halfway on that.
Yeah.
Which, I mean I guess not every encounter in an adventure can have, you know, jets of streaming lava or what have you, but that's sort of why I wanted this to have a little bit more, a few more examples of ways that I can have in a dynamic setting for my encounters that still makes sense and isn't just crazy over the top every single time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of in general, when they're in the published encounter design, not just here, but in a lot of the adventures and stuff, my main criticism is that what you're saying is that they're just, you know, oh, look, here's like, you know, you go into this spot, here's these monsters, you go into that spot, here's these monsters, you know, and I know in my home game, our games are a lot more than that, and I just don't feel that they're showing off how 4th Ed can be more than just linked encounters.
Totally, yeah. That's my number one complaint, too, about the published adventures.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then we get into Chapter 4, New Monsters. And this is the chapter that I think most people who are buying this book are buying this book for.
Yeah, this chapter is phenomenal. It's great. Like, even if you only like half the monsters, there's so many. It's cool.
Yeah, it starts off with new chromatic dragons, and it introduces the brown dragon. So convince me, why should I put a brown dragon in my game?
If you ever want to have an eating contest between dragons,
oh, an eating contest?
Yeah.
Oh.
Then you will need a brown dragon.
Okay.
You're in the desert, and you decided that the adventure needs more dragon cowbell.
Okay. So they're a desert-based dragon. They have a wing structure that seems very reminiscent to the gold dragons to me. You know, the big fans on along the side, all, you know, instead of the typical bat-like wings.
Yep. Yeah, I can see that.
And they've got the sand spray thing going on, tying in that, you know, I guess a lot of their abilities are sand-based, tying in that idea that they're out in the desert.
And they have the burrow speed, of course, to go, you know, through sand dunes and whatnot.
Yeah. Now, it would have been interesting if they would have had something like the Bulette. Or the Boulet, or however we're going to pronounce it, you know, to have the ability to come bursting out and have that be an actual attack, to have them be bursting out and of the sand and catch everybody by surprise. But I mean, you can sort of catch the flavor of that just with the burrow speed.
Yeah.
And then the next new dragon we have is the gray dragon. Why do I want a gray dragon in my game?
Yeah, these probably were the least interesting out of the new dragons to me.
Yeah, for me, it's all about the purple dragon. I like the purple dragon.
Yeah.
So the gray dragon, not real exciting?
I sort of pointed them at as being sort of like stone dragons, but I don't think their actual write-up is like that.
Sure.
Yeah, it says they're that they prefer the badlands, scrublands, dry prairies, and flatland terrain.
Okay. Well, that would make sense for a stone-type dragon, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the weaknesses of the Grey Dragon, at least, is that its environment isn't really kind of evocative. Like, at least with the brown dragon and the purple dragon, you can go, okay, that's where, you know, like every dragon sort of has a place where it's kind of from or at home in, and I just don't feel that with the Grey Dragon as much.
Mm-hmm. So you like the purple dragon then. Tell me why I need a purple dragon in my game.
Because you need a conniving, trickster, cool-looking dragon in your campaign.
With psychic powers.
Yes.
Right. So is the purple dragon the new shadow dragon?
They do seem to occupy similar conceptual ground.
In a lot of ways they do, I think.
Yeah.
Although I miss the old shadow dragon breath weapon of lose a percentage of your hit points. You know, it'll never kill you, but it'll really make you hurt.
I think the Shadow Dragon in some flavor is one of the Planar Dragons and further on.
Yeah.
But as far as, you know, mainline, deep underground dragon, Purple's the way to go.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is your Underdark, conniving, like you said, dragon that deals a lot with nightmares and... you know, you get to the ancient ones, and they've got things like a phasing strike and the nightmare prison. One of the things I've noticed I've missed with the new stat blocks is descriptions of attacks. Like, they've got all these really cool attacks, but they never actually tell me what they do. And the dragon, I think, exemplifies this a bit, because if I'm just looking at the stat block of the purple dragon, I look at their breath weapon and I have no idea what that is. I don't know how to describe that looking at the stat block. You know, it's not you know, a big cone of fire or soul sapping shadow or what have you. It's just breath weapon, psychic damage, close blast 10.
Yeah, they're definitely missing a little of the flavor on some of the. I mean, it's weird too, because with some of the powers, just the name of the power alone can sort of is striking enough to sort of motivate you to describe it, like the nightmare gaze.
Yes.
One that you know, oh, nightmare gaze. Like, okay, I can work with that. But then, you know, again, you get to breath weapon. If they don't do a good job naming it, then you're SOL.
Absolutely. Yep.
I had that problem before, though, too. Not just 4th edition.
Where they were just,
yeah, some weird attacks. Like, the Umber Hulk's confusion attack, I, like, always came up with something ridiculous to explain it.
Sure. I can see that. But you like the purple dragon, and they're creepy, and they're crawly, and they'll get at you when you're not expecting it.
Yeah, my favorite thing, actually, is their weakness, that they're totally obliterated by direct sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of possibilities there.
That is really cool. It's sort of the vampire of the draconic world in that way.
A little bit,
just the idea of getting that you might see PCs trying to lure them into a situation where they could cave the roof in and bring the sunlight on them or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, anything else on the big new three new chromatic dragons?
Yeah. Good to see them.
Yeah.
And then we get a whole section on wormlings. On, in case you wanted to have a baby dragon for your first or second level PCs to beat up on.
And then have the mother show up.
And then have mom show up. Because, I mean, the most powerful one is what, a fifth level elite? And that's the red, but they go all the way down to level one. So if you do, I mean, you can legitimately have dragons in your game at level one. It's tough to do that just out of the Monster Manual, but with the wormlings, you can pull that off. Which I suppose is necessary if you're going to encourage people to have campaigns based around dragons, because it's hard to have a campaign based on a dragon if there's no actual dragons at early levels.
And it's not necessarily just being a challenge rating appropriate, you know, if you want to set up that this dragon has a lot of kids.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense, too.
You want to have, like, a horde of obnoxious blue dragons.
Yeah, it almost would have been interesting to see them statted out as minions at higher levels.
Yeah,
that's an interesting thought, yeah.
Because then it would make sense to have, you know, the 10th level PCs wandering in and taking on Mom, but having a, you know, 10 babies fly out of the next door cavern and really harass the PCs.
Yeah, I've done that with a couple other monsters where the baby version was just a minion, mm-hmm. you know, with the same stats except for a hit point.
Right. And then it gets into Planar Dragons, and we've got some new versions of Planar Dragons. Now, now their take on Planar Dragons tends to be take an already existent dragon that just spends too much time on one plane, and it's modified them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the Abyssal Dragon, which seems to more or less be a white dragon that spends too much time in the Abyss, and now it has all this armor riveted into its flesh and little demons and imps that fly around constantly attaching this armor and keeping it on and doing horrible things to it.
And see, some people would think that's cheesy, but I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I would agree with you on that. I looked at the Frostforge and I thought that was cool, just, you know, like you're fighting it and, you know, you blast off a bit of the, you know, instead of scales, it has these metal plates and you knock off one of the metal plates and some imps are like screwing it back on in the middle of combat.
Well, and I would be willing to go along with the it comes off a little corny, except that the picture of it is actually really cool.
Yeah.
And it totally sells me on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that in a situation like that, I would kind of wish I would see more. I kind of wish the stats would make me feel more like I'm fighting that creature that I see in the picture, though, you know?
Mm.
There's just not a lot there to make me feel like this is a white dragon running around with imps sticking armor on it all the time.
Yeah, it varies by monster how well they're able to really pull it off, I think.
Right. But then you also have astral dragons, dragons that spend too much time over in the astral plane, hanging out with in the domains of gods.
Mm-hmm.
Any astral dragons that stand out to you?
There's the pack dragon, of course, that that gets Yankee ride.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That one's crucial.
Yeah.
Well, and that ties into some of the history of the Gith. They've always had this thing with dragons, and red dragons specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So that ties in very well and takes it to the next logical step, the next evolution of not only do they have this pact with red dragons, but they've actually gone so far as to modify these dragons to better suit their needs.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets into elemental dragons. Any elemental dragons that stand out as particularly interesting? Now, looking at these, it's hard to say that these are dragons that are normal dragons that spend too much time in the elemental chaos. These seem like they're dragons made for specifically for the elemental chaos.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this. I look at the elder dragon eel, and I cannot tell you what chromatic dragon that might have originally been. It seems like a unique dragon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough because the dragons are elemental creatures to begin with.
Right.
There's only so much you can throw on top of them to really make it like, oh, this dragon's extra fire.
Yeah, I suppose. And then you have the Feywild dragons, which is where they bring in the ever-popular fairy dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Famous munchkin familiar.
Yes.
Yeah.
But you also have the Mirage Dragon and the Wretch Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move into Shadowfell Dragons, which is sort of like, take a dragon that's had a bad day for its entire life.
I kind of like, just from the picture and basic description of it, the Blight Dragon
mm-hmm.
just feels sort of, you know, the Blight Dragons are cool when you just want something like Turesque. Like, just like some sort of brutal force of nature that's just going to come in. And, you know, like normal dragons, you know, there's, you know, they're intelligent creatures, there's subtlety mixed in with the power. And the Blight Dragon is just, I hate you. And it's just going to sort of burn down everything, you know, and you want to sort of put something like that in the campaign. It's cool.
Yeah, right on. Yeah.
it also takes on people's crops, you know. It's not just like, I'm going to go kill people, you know, I'm going to go ruin your corn.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really like a walking natural disaster, just like everything it walks by just gets messed up.
So it's not just I'm going to eat you, but I'm going to eat you and then make it hard for your village to survive after I'm gone.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also where you end up with your shadow dragon, which I suppose makes sense that the shadow dragon would be a Shadowfell dragon, which is a tough encounter at, you know, 24th level solo, but also has a very necrotic sort of connection,
mm-hmm.
you know, with its bite doing necrotic damage and its breath weapon doing necrotic damage. Which I suppose makes some sense to the history of the Shadow Dragon. It still feels different to me than the old Shadow Dragon. You know, it doesn't feel wrong, but it does feel like it's not exactly the same dragon.
Yeah, I think they got their concept tweaked a bit to working with the cosmology.
Yeah, that makes sense. But then we move into undead dragons, where you can do all kinds of super terrific fun things with Dracoliches.
Yes.
Because having an undead Dracolich isn't enough, but you need your Dracolich to also have extra little tweaks to it as well. Like the Dream Breath, or the Ice Rod Dracoliches.
Yeah, you know, Dream Breath doesn't really strike fear into my heart, but maybe that's just me. It's like the Broadway musical dragon.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like with the different, like the Ice Rot and the Dream Breath, that those could have been just sort of like almost like templates for a Dracolich. And I'm not sure that I felt they really needed different stats per se, but
I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you.
And then you get into... But here's where I think they do really well, is that I like that they then bring in all these new different mm-hmm. types of undead dragons, which we haven't had. I mean, they started to sort of do some of that in 3rd edition, but it wasn't ever very common to have undead dragons other than an animated skeleton or an actual Dracolich, and there wasn't much in between.
Right.
But now we've got sections on, you know, all kinds of different... two different kinds of wraith dragons, and a handful of different kinds of zombie dragons, and then the skeletal dragons, and then the vampiric dragons, and so it brings in all, you know, the idea that dragons can be more than just one type of undead, and it works.
I used the winged protrescence just a little bit ago. It was a lot of fun. It was basically sort of they'd run into. Dragon before there was sort of like a pair of young dragons that they were fighting, and the dumb one just went sort of charging at him at one point, and they killed it, and then the smart one brought it back through rituals of the winged protrescence, and they had to like run against it again. It was pretty fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. Like all these dragons that you killed now can come back in a variety of ways.
Yeah.
That is great to be able to, you know, it's not just the old tradition of the bad guy runs away. In this case, you've actually legitimately killed it, and yet it still manages to come back more powerful than before and kill you again.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And then we get into the other creatures section, where we have things like the Abishai.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a... close to correct pronunciation, do we think?
Sure.
Close enough for me.
Yeah.
These are sort of your draconic demons. Are we going to call these demons? I guess they're not technically demons.
Demon-esque.
And they're immortals, so maybe they're more devilish. Yeah, they're called devil-like.
Yeah.
But you also have things like different things that you might hide in the horde. That they're not expecting, like the Horde Scarab. And you've got a bunch of new builds for Dragonborn.
Including ones that get wings, which PC Dragonborn still can't get.
Yeah. I suspect someday we'll see that.
Yeah.
I don't know how that'll happen, if it'll be You know, they haven't done anything with, you know, regarding like race books like they have traditionally in previous books or in editions. So I wonder if someday we'll see a race book where we'll have a Paragon path where dragonborn characters can fly.
Yeah, that's got to be coming some point.
Yeah.
But then we also get a variety of dragon spawn, a different spawn for each color type.
Those were other monsters that I really liked in third edition. They came out with a whole bunch of miniatures for it, too. They were pretty cool.
Yeah, they were. And they've continued the tradition to support the idea of a variety of different drakes as well. I was impressed to see drakes in the fourth edition Monster Manual.
Because
they hadn't sort of gotten that level of support before. And there were some things that I've seen done and that I've done with drakes in the past that were really sort of, I liked the idea of them being in the world. And now we've got more rules for them. So we get some new drakes, including ones that might mess with things in a more magical nature, like the portal drake that, you know, deals with portals and following you along when you try to run away, and has the portal burst ability and things like that.
Yeah, the portal drake's one of my favorite monsters from this whole book. Just the fact that it's this weird teleporting dragon-like thing that can teleport you all around.
Yeah. And then, of course, we need to have, what, 4 or 5 more pages on kobolds?
Of course.
Everybody's favorite creature to kick around.
I like that the Kobold Victory Table finally made it into a published book.
Yeah.
And that's something that started out in Mike Merle's personal blog.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's finally, that made its way into an official product. I think that's pretty cool.
And the idea of the Kobold Victory Table is that if a kobold drops a character, you get to roll a d20 and cool things happen.
Yes.
You know? Like the number 20, you roll a 20 and the phrase is "fear me," and the kobold gains +2 on attack rolls and damage. And damage, and a +1 to defenses until the end of the encounter. You know, I've become a super kobold because I actually dropped somebody once.
Yeah. It's like they're establishing themselves as, you know, the ultimate underdog, a critter in D&D, and then trying to subvert it a little bit.
Absolutely. And then we get into the living breath, which ties into the breath weapon concept sort of coming to its own. The squamous thing. Wow, they don't like to make things easy to pronounce around here, do they?
Oh.
Yeah.
And the squamous thing seems to more or less, I'm not entirely sure why I need this as opposed to just more varieties of a gibbering mouther.
You know, it's like if you want to get some Lovecraft in your dragons.
I suppose. It's a little Lovecraftian dragonish.
Yeah.
I can see that.
More Far Realms critters, at the very least. But you're right. I mean, when you look at it, you're just like, wow, this is a bizarre mouth thing. Not necessarily dragon thing.
Right. And then we get into the section that I imagine is the first place that a lot of people turn when they buy this book, because they're looking for their favorite dragon in D&D history. And that's the Dragon Hall of Fame. I know this was the first place I went when I first cracked open the book, because I wanted to see what dragons made it and which ones didn't and how they statted them out. This is where they take specific dragons from specific stories or encounters or adventures or whatever from previous editions and have updated them to 4th edition so you can put them in your campaign and kill your PCs with them.
Yeah, I flipped to this section first too, but for a slightly different reason. I had read from the previews that Tiamat was there. And you could fight Tiamat.
Mm-hmm.
Which is tough to swallow in a setting where they make Tiamat a god.
Well, I like sort of how 4th Ed seems to be going back to this whole notion. Like in 1st Ed, you know, like the gods were like really just there to be killed, right? Like, you know, they were there, you know, in statted up. Right, you know, and they were hard to kill, but you know, you could do it. And I like this whole thing of fightable, killable gods, in the sense of just making it, bringing it back where characters can get to that level if they, if you want to run your game that way.
Well, and Tiamat has always, in my mind, has always been different depending on what setting I'm running. You know, if I'm running a Dragonlance campaign, then Tiamat is not really something that you can fight.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm running, if I'm running a Forgotten Realms game, that might be a different story. You know,
or the D&D cartoon.
And well, yeah, and for a long, and for a long time, Tiamat in many campaigns wasn't even a god, but was it a demon lord?
Yes,
I think she was a demon. You know, and that was a whole different take on her. Obviously, you could kill Tiamat if she's a demon lord. Well, I mean, not that demon lords are easy to take out.
Yeah, well, it's also, in this specific lay, it's not just, hey, you're at 30th level, let's go fight Tiamat at the end. You specifically, it tells you you have to undertake some big quest to actually get her not to just, you know, disappear when you bloody her, you know?
Right.
It's this whole involved thing where you're not just, you know, it's not another monster. It makes him feel more godlike when you have to go through all these epic steps.
Yeah. And even, you know, I guess even in 4th edition, they can't find a way to take a 35th level solo creature who's also a god and make a simple stat block for it.
No.
It just doesn't work. I mean, her stat block is nearly the entire page.
Yeah. And she gets things like quintuple actions and quintuple brain, so sort of like fighting, you know, 5 epic monsters at once.
Absolutely. Yeah. And who doesn't want to do that?
Yeah.
Any other dragons from history that stand out as being notable?
Nothing that was really bowling me over, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, there were some that I recognize, but I don't know. For the most part, it seems like, oddly enough, in a game called Dungeons & Dragons, there aren't dragons that are famous enough for me to remember for a long time.
Yeah, there's
a few, but...
Yeah, I read all of the, you know, the mainline Dragonlance books when I was in middle school and high school, but I can't remember any of their names now, you know?
Me neither, nah.
It tells me in there that Cyan Bloodbane was from this one book, and I'm like, okay, that makes sense, but...
Yeah, I remembered him. That was the only one I think I remembered. And then you got a few templates. I don't know. The templates seemed okay by me.
Yeah. I haven't used templates at all yet in 4th edition.
Yeah, templates in 4th edition are a lot less exciting to me than they were in 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
What I find fun and interesting, though, is the next section on alternative powers. You know, ways that you can take a dragon of whatever color and take away this power but add this one in, change that power and do this instead and do that kind of stuff, and it suddenly takes your dragon in a whole different direction. Mm-hmm. That can throw your players off. You know, it still feels like a red dragon, but they weren't expecting it to do a shockwave attack because that's not in the monster manual, you know?
Right. And the old Dragonomicon handled that through all these different feats that your dragons could take.
Uh-huh.
That totally made them weird. But I like this approach a bit better where you can just say, well, he's got this different power instead.
Right. What do we think about the bloodline alternative powers, though?
The bloodlines. These are pretty cool too. I mean, I like just having the options there.
I guess the idea, if I'm understanding the bloodline, the polychromatic blood dragon bloodlines is like, I have a green dragon, but they have some black dragon blood in them.
Mm-hmm.
So you can change some things up here.
Mm-hmm.
It almost, if you used it too much, I think it would muddle things.
Yeah.
You know, if you used it once, maybe twice, I think you can get away with it. But I think if you use that section very much, it's going to muddle things quickly and it's going to become a big mess.
I think you'd have a lot of players crying foul too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of those things, just like with the alternative powers too. I think it works best with your players if there's some way that you can have maybe like another similar dragon, like to use it in contrast, so you can sort of set up the, because the best part about these things is a sort of surprise factor, in it. So, you know, they're fighting a white dragon, you know, before, and, you know, they were used to sort of what it was doing. Mm-hmm. And then later they run into another white dragon or something. But this one has fire breath. That's going to catch them with their pants down, and they'll have a sort of a nice little surprise factor on that.
And I guess I just feel like if I want to have the surprise factor on my players, there's other ways that are more effective to do it and that make more sense in the world of the game to me. I guess I'd have a hard time buying that there's very much mixing of dragons going on.
You guys heard the story about the white dragon?
Tell it.
I think this was posted as a Wizards update a long time ago, but just that in the campaign they kept talking about this fearsome white dragon, and so the PCs prepped all this anti-cold stuff and all this fire stuff. And when they fought it was a white W-I-G-H-T dragon.
That's good. I like
that. Yeah.
Well, in any case, any last thoughts on the Draconomicon?
My general opinion is if you're going to do anything with dragons in your campaign, you should probably own the book. It's just got a ton of stuff that you can use for it. If you're not going to do anything with dragons, then it's probably a pass till you're going to.
I think that's fair.
But it's still a solid book. It's a really solid book for what it's doing.
What are your final thoughts there, Dave?
My main problem is that my last 3.5 campaign before I started 4th edition was a dragon-heavy campaign. And so I'm like sort of burnt out on dragons. So I haven't really used much from it, but I think it's a really well put together book. It's got pretty much everything I'd want. It doesn't, like you're saying, it's just a DM book. It doesn't muddy the waters with including random player options, which I like a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it really sets the tone for these other sort of monster specific books.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess my general impression with the book is that I think if you're going to use a dragon as an encounter in your game, you don't need this book. If you want to make dragons any sort of central point in your game, if you want to have an arc that follows the schemes of a dragon, if you want to have a dragon-heavy campaign, if you want to have a party of dragon slayers, then I think this book is going to be critical to helping you be successful in doing that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when it all comes down, the cover price on the book is $39.95. And over at the Tomes Amazon store, you can get it for $26.37. So either support your local store or head over and support the show. But I think if you're going to use, like I said, if you're going to have a dragons in your game that are more than just the end of the dungeon or an occasional encounter, I think it's worth that cover price.
Or if you just want to beat up Tiamat.
Or, yeah, if you want to beat up Tiamat, which, I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah, really.
She's kind of a jerk.
I'm probably going to go beat up Tiamat after the show.
Sweet.
Oh, cool, yeah. Maybe I'll see you there.
Speaking of after the show, that has been our review of the Draconomicon. I want to thank once again Quinn, the Game Fiend, for being on.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find him over at the At Will blog. I'll let you give the address, but it'll also be linked in the show notes.
It's @-will.omnivangelist.net.
And we have Dave Chalker from the Critical Hits blog, which is a critical hit.
Thank you. critical-hits.com. I also want to point out that I run rpgbloggers.com, which all three of us are members of.
Absolutely. And you can find all kinds of blogging goodness, and all three of those sites now will be linked in our show notes. And thanks both of you for being on.
Thanks
for having me.
And there's the Draconomicon. Well, that's episode 97. You can email the show at thetomeshow@gmail.com, swing by the forums and tell us how you use dragons in your game, and find all your geeky news at vorpalnetwork.com, or follow the Vorpal Network on Twitter. Also, don't forget to tell at least two buddies about the show this week. That's your challenge. And feel free to swing by the Tomes Amazon store for products discussed on the show and more. The show gets part of the proceeds, and that helps keep us on the air, and it's all run through Amazon. So, if you can get products from Amazon, you can get them from the Tome. Links for things mentioned in the show can be found in the show notes on the website at thetomeshow.com, and this has been episode 97, Draconomicon, Chromatic Dragons of The Tome.
I'm on the wall.